ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Monday, the 16th of February. I'm Melissa Clark in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. If a store increases prices and then brings them back down, is that a real discount or a deception? A highly anticipated legal case that kicks off today will examine just that, with supermarket giant Coles going on trial over allegations it misled customers. The case claims Coles created fake discounts on hundreds of supermarket items, something it disputes. Experts say the case could result in widespread changes to how retailers price discounts. National Consumer Affairs reporter Michael Atkin has more.
Paniora Nukunuku was outraged when he saw a tin of corned beef in his local Coles cost $8.20, turning that anger into a video he posted on TikTok. A competitor was selling an alternative product for much less.
I have never been so triggered by food than in that very moment right there. Because, again, corned beef is not a luxury food, it's a staple food.
He's one of a growing number of social media users that drew attention to the major supermarkets' pricing practices, with the consumer watchdog saying that digital people power had an influence on its decision to sue Coles.
I definitely think social media has become one of the new tools of making the playing field equal.
The ACCC is suing Coles, claiming the supermarket giant misled customers on hundreds of items with illusory or fake discounts. There's also a separate case against Woolworths. Former consumer watchdog boss Alan Fells says the stakes couldn't be higher.
The stakes are enormous, both for Coles and the ACCC. It's the case of the century because it affects not only Coles and Woolies, but millions of businesses who discount.
The lawsuit alleges Coles sold products at a regular price for at least 6 months before they were increased for a short period before being slashed and promoted as a down-down discount. However, the ACCC claims customers weren't really getting a big saving. The price was actually higher or the same as the first price. Alan Fells says the court will have to be convinced that amounts to a serious breach of consumer law.
And so if those price drops had been preceded by big price rises, then the court may well conclude it was misleading and deceptive.
Graham Samuel succeeded Alan Fells at the ACCC and was in the top job for almost a decade until 2011.
And if that case is proven by the ACCC, then frankly they deserve to have the book thrown at them in the heaviest way. If they happen to lose because there is another explanation, that has some pretty serious consequences for the ACCC, because there will be suggestions, accusations that they instituted these proceedings because of the political pressure that was around at the time.
Coles told AM Mr. Nukunuku's video did not compare similar products. One was a house brand from Brazil, while the Coles one was Australian made, and it has another cheaper product that wasn't mentioned. The supermarket chain has rejected the ACCC's central allegation the down-down discounts were illusory and claims the price rises were justified, citing high inflation and supplier demands.
Michael Atkin reporting there with Lucy Kent. To federal politics, the new-look Liberal leadership team has begun outlining its policy agenda following last week's spill. Both Angus Taylor and his deputy Jane Hume are focusing on tax, immigration, childcare and nuclear power. But for now, the pair are tight-lipped on the details as they begin the mammoth task of trying to claw back voter support for the Liberal Party. Political reporter Lexi Junowick has more from Parliament House.
Fresh off a leadership spill victory, Angus Taylor hit the road in his electorate of Hume, visiting Goulburn, about 2 hours southwest of Sydney on Saturday, before dropping into a Western Sydney shopping centre on Sunday with this pledge.
We're going to fight hard against Labor's planned tax on the home. We're going to fight hard against Labor's inflation.
48 hours into taking the reins of Deputy Leader of the Liberals, Senator Jane Hume was calling for an immigration policy reset and a rethink of nuclear power.
If people were open-minded to the idea of lifting the moratorium on nuclear energy, which is a bill that I brought forward as a backbencher, so that we can have a zero emissions technology introduced into our country, as every other developed nation has either done or is in the process of doing, well, then that would add to that energy abundance that would bring prices down over time.
The nuclear policy the opposition took to the 2025 election was found in a Labor review to be a key part of why the coalition suffered its worst ever defeat, while research from Australia's National Science Organisation, the CSIRO, determined that renewable energy supported by storage and gas is the cheapest form of new power.
What I will say is it's absolutely crazy to have an ideological approach to towards energy, because it's energy that drives our economy.
Jane Hume says the government's plan for universal childcare is also in the Liberals' sights, but whether that could include broadening subsidies for families remains unclear.
Again, I'm not going to be talking about specific policies on air 48 hours after I've been appointed the Deputy Leader of the Liberal Party, before we've even had our first Shadow Cabinet meeting.
Queensland Senator James McGrath, who resigned from Shadow Cabinet before Friday's spill, is confident Australians will see firmer policies from the opposition much sooner than the next federal election campaign trail.
All shadow ministers, once they are appointed to the shadow ministry, will be given their marching orders to ensure that policy development is accelerated.
Also on the horizon, a refreshed shadow cabinet. Andrew Wallace was shadow attorney general under Susan Lee's leadership. Are you confident that you'll hang on to your most recent portfolio of shadow attorney general?
Well, I would like to continue to serve as the Shadow Attorney General or in some other way in Shadow Cabinet, if Angus thinks that's appropriate.
While Mr Taylor clearly has his sights on trying to win back voters in time for the 2028 federal election, his first big leadership test will come much sooner, thanks to predecessor Susan Lee's decision to quit politics. Her move vacates the regional New South Wales seat of Farrer, and already challengers are lining up for the by-election, including One Nation and independent Michelle Millthorpe, who's released a glossy campaign video on social media.
For too long, the major parties have taken us for granted, and I'm here to make sure your voices reach Canberra.
On Sunday, the Nationals' New South Wales branch opened nominations for the Farrer by-election. Senator James McGrath says he's preparing for a show-stopping battle, regardless of how the field of contenders shapes up.
I think it's going to be very tough for the Liberal Party, regardless of who runs.
That's Queensland Liberal Senator James McGrath, ending that report by Lexi Junawick. Susan Lee's departure has been followed by the loss of the Liberal Party's champion for female representation, Charlotte Mortlock. She's quit both the party and the organisation she founded to support female Liberal recruits called Hilmers Network. Annie Guest reports.
Karen Andrews was a federal minister and represented the Liberals in the Gold Coast seat of Macpherson for 15 years. She describes what she says was an appalling lack of respect for women in Parliament and the Liberal Party.
You know, historically, there has been some issues with the way that women within the party have been treated.
One person trying to change that was Charlotte Mortlock, who led Hilmers Network for 4 years, hosting events around the country to recruit and support women to become Liberal MPs. She's now quit the role and the party. Karen Andrews says she's a big loss.
I was disappointed to hear that. Charlotte has worked very hard to raise support for women within the party.
In announcing her departure online, Charlotte Mortlock described having challenged her party to evolve, but that after recent events, she's decided to support women in other ways. While Charlotte Mortlock had unsuccessfully pushed for quotas for female representation, her resignation came just days after the Liberal Party axed its first female leader.
Whether that was quotas, whether that was the end of Susan Lee's leadership, or whether it was a combination of that and other things, I don't know, and that's for Charlotte to say.
But it's not a great sign in terms of championing women in the Liberal Party, is it?
Look, no, it's not. And I don't think anyone should pretend that it is. I mean, the timing is pretty significant. I think maybe it represents a lot of frustration over many years for Charlotte, as she's worked very hard to get some change through the party.
Support for the Liberal Party amongst women has dropped to its lowest levels ever over the past two elections. And Karen Andrews thinks Susan Lee's ousting might not help.
So I think that there's a reasonable possibility that the party will get some pushback from those people who did not think that Susan Lee was treated fairly.
And what about you? Do you think that she was treated unfairly because she was a woman?
I think it would have been extraordinarily difficult for anyone who had been the leader and overseen a decline in primary vote from 32 to 18, as it was polled in some areas, for them to be able to survive. So I don't think it did at the end when she lost the leadership. Whether or not there were issues along the way is really something for Susan to speak up about, as to whether or not she thought there was an issue.
Former Federal Minister Karen Andrews there, ending that report by Annie Guest. First-year enrolments at Australian universities have hit a record high this year, with a jump in applications to study compared to last year. More students will be studying social work, engineering, science, teaching and nursing, with offers for undergraduate degrees in those fields up significantly. I spoke to the Federal Education Minister, Jason Clare, a short time ago. Jason Clare, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Mel.
Let's go to uni places. There is a jump in applications for undergraduate places, up 4.6%, but offers are only up 2.5%. Are places keeping up with demand?
Well, there's plenty of demand, and that's a good thing, because we need more people with more skills, whether it's a uni degree or whether it's a TAFE qualification. More and more jobs are going to require more skills in the years ahead. Under Bob Hawke and Paul Keating, they increased the number of people finishing high school from about 40% to 80%. We think that by the middle of this century, about 80% of the entire workforce will need either a TAFE qualification or a university degree. And that's why the data that's out today is so important. More Australians will start a uni degree this year than ever before. And as you say, it's more teachers, it's more nurses, it's more scientists, it's more engineers. I think teaching's up 6%. Nursing is up 6%, science is up 8%, engineering's up 9%, and social work up 19%. And it's not happening by accident. It's happening because we're investing more in our universities to enable people to do those courses.
There's certainly an increase in demand in many of those STEM-related areas. There's been some concern that's due to the Morrison government's Jobs Ready graduate scheme, which is just making arts and humanities and communications degrees much more expensive. Is that what's happening here? Is the pricing pushing more people to consider studying STEM degrees?
I don't think that's necessarily the case. People choose the courses that they like, that they love, that they're interested in. But certainly also true that the Job Ready Graduates scheme has failed. It was a recommendation of the university's accord for us to make changes here. We've already bitten off a big chunk of that report. I think we've implemented now about 31 or 32 of its 47 recommendations in part or in full. One of the things we did at the election, you might remember, is we cut student debt by 20%. That's now happened. That's taken
dollars. I do want to come to that, but can we just stay with the Jobs Ready program, because you've established a commission to set up a new funding model.
That's right.
When will that be ready?
Well, hopefully that will pass through the Parliament when Parliament returns in March. It's been passed through the House of Representatives. The Senate committee is looking at that legislation right now. We're expecting its report at the end of next week.
Going back then to the HECS debt, you wiped 20% off existing student debts last year, and there were some other changes around indexation and the minimum threshold. But for all of these new students starting this year, they won't have the benefit of that 20% reduction. Would you consider doing that again in the forthcoming budget?
Oh, I'm not going to preempt what might be or might not be in the budget, but can I make this point, Mel? As well as cutting student debt by 20%, which wiped about $16 billion off the shoulders of 3 million young Australians, the other change we made to HECS, which was a very big and important structural change to HECS, was to reduce the amount you have to repay every year. For someone earning $70,000 a year, it means that they have to repay every year about $1,300 less. So it's more money in your pocket rather than the government's. The architect of HEX last year described it as the most important structural reform to the HEX system in decades.
But if you acknowledge that students in 2025 were struggling with the debt burden of their debts to the point that a 20% reduction was sufficient, the economic conditions are really quite similar for students starting this year. Surely the case is the same that they would need the debt relief that students that were in the same circumstances last year required.
Well, there's no doubt here there's more work to do, and we'll keep working through the recommendations. Talk to a lot of students, they'll talk to you not only about the cost of the degree, but the cost of living while they're studying for their degree. That's why things like paid prac are so important. For the first time ever, we're now providing financial support for students while they do their practical training. And something else which I think is important, there's a way that we can make getting a degree quicker and cheaper by getting universities to count your TAFE qualifications first. At Western Sydney University this year, if you've done a TAFE qualification in nursing or in early education, for example, they'll take a year off your degree and up to $18,000 off the cost of the degree. And that's good, but I'd like to see other universities do that too.
Jason Clear, thanks very much for speaking to us.
Good on you. Thanks very much.
The Federal Education Minister, Jason Clear, there. Indigenous cultural fishing on the New South Wales south coast has been a contentious issue for decades. Traditional owners face fines and jail time for exercising rights that are recognised in native title legislation but are not protected in state fisheries management regulations. Last month, a multi-million dollar case against seven abalone divers collapsed mid-trial. Now, subpoenaed documents reveal the case had fallen apart before the trial had even started. Vanessa Milton reports.
It was the biggest case in decades against Indigenous cultural fishers on the New South Wales south coast. Seven men, including six native title holders, faced charges of trafficking thousands of blacklip abalone with a maximum penalty of 10 years in prison. But subpoenaed documents reveal the case had already fallen apart before it went to trial. At the heart of the failed prosecution was evidence that could have been used in the defence of the accused men, but could not be disclosed in court.
If there's something that we don't know about but could be a basis that the court would find our clients were not guilty, then we of course wanted to know about that.
Jalal Razi acted as barrister for one of the seven defendants.
I've never come across a case where there has been an issue of non-disclosure where it has concerned something at the heart of the very charges themselves. From my experience and from my research, that has been unprecedented.
Earlier this month, New South Wales Police was ordered to pay almost $2 million in defence costs after withdrawing from the prosecution 11 days into the trial. Documents subpoenaed by the defence team include emails from the New South Wales government's top legal advisers dating back to almost 2 years before the trial, advising prosecutors that they faced a problem meeting their duty of disclosure over this confidential evidence, which impacts any prosecution where a native title defence could be used. But New South Wales Police pressed on with this trial regardless.
The big question is why they would do it.
Werribee man and barrister Tony McAvoy is Australia's first Indigenous senior counsel.
If the prosecution understood that there wasn't a proper basis for the prosecution, then there has to be some investigation of that. There has to be some reason given as to why they pressed on.
New South Wales Police did not respond to questions from the ABC about when it first became aware of the evidence disclosure issue and why it continued on with the trial. In a statement, a spokesperson said the New South Wales Police Force acknowledges the ruling by the court and will examine the details of the cost order. New South Wales Agriculture Minister Tara Moriarty declined an interview and would not answer questions from the ABC over whether fisheries compliance action against known native title holders should now cease. For the lead defendant in the case, Walbunja elder Keith Nye, the legal uncertainty means that taking his nephews out for a dive, continuing a practice that has been handed down for generations, still comes with the risk of prosecution.
If we don't hand it down culture, it will fade away, just like they wanted to do in the 1700s, 1800s, and the 1900s. abolish the Aboriginal culture way of life.
Walbunja Elder Keith Nye, ending that report by Vanessa Milton. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Melissa Clark.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. We know Donald Trump doesn't like losing elections. Now, with the midterms in just over 8 months' time, there's concern he's trying to fiddle with the voting system. Today, law professor Rick Hassan from UCLA on Trump's tactics and whether he can get away with trying to meddle with US democracy again. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.